The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Thank you all for coming out here. Honestly, I was like, oh man, I'm going up against Kendi. Ain't no one gonna show up to my talk. So this is really good. I really appreciate that. Jesse Agopi and I are gonna be signing Teaching for Black Lives at that book signing too. So we're doing double duty at the same time. So if you wanna come get your book signed. And then in terms of rethinking schools, as an editor, I'm in trouble if I don't promote it. So please check out the latest issue of Rethinking Schools and subscribe. Usually our editor, Ari Bloomcats, will be around here somewhere, maybe at the signing. We're usually selling like $10 for a subscription. This latest issue has a piece on the teacher rebellions, the teacher strikes, and then also a reflection from Stan Karp and, I mean, a reflection from Bob Peterson, social justice union activist, around how do we think about the post-unionizing and the post-Janus world. So what I'm going to do today is I'm actually going to treat this a little bit like a book reading, sort of in promo of the book, and also just love to sort of, I'm going to like read some from the intro, talk through some of the chapters and the ideas I'm kicking around and the things that I'm really going after in this space, read a little from the last chapter, and then just open it up for us to have questions. I really struggle, honestly, sometimes. You know, I came to socialism for the first time last year, and it's such a wonderful space, but also, like, you know, the teacher in me wants to figure out how do we do, like, a more interactive lesson plan instead of having all these talking heads all the time, but then I didn't have the energy to pull one together for myself for this as well, so, I'm guilty in the same way. Honestly, Bill, I just want to recognize you being here. He came out to see me especially, and I appreciate that. Bill's been sort of a hero to so many of us on the left, but he's also been a wonderful mentor for me as I went through grad school and everything, so I really appreciate that, Bill. Let me get started. So I'm going to read some from the intro of the book and then talk through some of the chapters and really think this through, and I want to think out loud with y'all about some of these ideas I'm doing in this work. Also, let me say out loud, I want to thank Dana as well at Haymarket and Julie as well, just for working on this book. It's been very much a labor of love for me and something I've had in the wings for a very, very long time. And that's really what I used to open up the book. Okay. So I've been scared to write this book for a long time and for a lot of reasons. Part of my fear comes from my understanding of U.S. history, and that here in the heart of the empire, and in one of the centers of global neoliberalism, capitalist ideology and economics reign supreme. The powerful have worked hard through textbooks and the media to construct a common sense understanding that capitalism is a normal, if not progressive, manifestation of natural human relations, an inevitable outcome of human evolution. For those of us living in the United States, this hegemonic pro-capitalist common sense is built on a constructed historical memory that is at once anti-communist, anti-socialist, and anti-Marxist. It's a fictive narrative that both individual freedom and societal equality can be attained through self-interested competition while completely disregarding structural and material inequalities. And this feels so weird, right? Because I wrote this, you know, a year and a half ago at least, right? Really, before I came, in terms of the writing and the publication cycle. So the 2016 election of Donald Trump as president of the United States has also heightened fears of right-wing attacks, which have gotten worse, right? Even in this, as soon as this came out, within a week, Campus Reform had posted something on it, and so I had to like scrub websites and stuff of my email information and was trying to sort of get ahead of any potential right-wing backlash. The mass hysteria of the Red Scare and McCarthyism of the 1950s that once felt so far off is now suddenly and intimately close to us again as the new American proto-fascists rise to power, as we face leftist professor watch lists, death threats made against socialist professors, talk of imprisonment for flag burning, proposals for Muslim registries in incarceration camps, threats to immigrants, attacks on the rights of women in the LGBTQ community, and promises to dismantle the public sector in the name of the free market. The white nationalists in power, the ruling class that is supporting them, are firmly drawing a definition of what is quote-unquote American and entrenching whiteness, maleness, Christianity, heterosexuality, and free market capitalism as the only acceptable currency of the land, all else be bankrupt or be damned. My fears are also grounded in my own awareness of profound political misunderstandings of Marxism by those around me. I work a lot with liberal and progressive activists in education organizing, as well as in my professional capacity as an education professor. Together, we have fought back against various free market educational reforms, from high-stakes testing and standards, to charter schools, to private school vouchers, to school closings, to corporate curriculum, to mayoral control of school districts, to public school defunding. There is an angst among these allies. They feel an alienation from a system of education that so clearly does not meet their children's or their community's needs. And they feel the loss of power and of democratic governance that comes from neoliberal models of deregulation and market competition. However, because of the pervasiveness of anti-communist, anti-socialist, and anti-Marxist common sense in the United States, many of these allies are fearful of crossing a threshold of understanding that our critiques of those reforms are fundamentally and deeply rooted critiques of capitalism and its shaping of our entire system of public education. It sometimes seems that, for these allies, even though they see and acknowledge all the inequalities around us, critiquing capitalism is just too far beyond the horizon of quote-unquote acceptable or feasible options within the struggle for educational justice. This fear and denial then preempts any discussion of how, if we truly intend to create a system of education built on the fundamentals of justice and equality, we must attack and overthrow the very system that our schools are built on, one that is predicated on and requires injustice and inequality. These liberal and progressive allies have not read or even entertained reaching for Marx and Marxist critiques of capitalism, leaving ample room for misunderstandings, misconstructions, and a mistrust of Marxism. And I'm going to talk about it in a minute, but you know, I also come from a leftist family and leftist tradition, and so I am a little bit fearfully aware of the left's history and practice of cannibalizing itself, posturing about who is the most radical and rupturing under harsh critique. While I strongly believe in struggle, and I mean difficult struggle over political differences and understandings, I've seen enough allies and comrades torn down to know that almost anything I write within the broad framework of Marxist analysis will inevitably come under attack for both the right and the left. For this reason, there are a lot of topics that I don't really take up in this space, okay? And there are tomes that are written on various left ideological fights and political lines, and my strategy has always been to start with Marx and dialectical materialism, letting my analysis extend from that as a base and staying above the fray, or trying to stay above the fray. My trepidation to write this book extends in part from my position in the academy as well. If Marxism is not particularly popular among U.S. Marxism these days, and it's certainly the case within educational scholarship, mostly work explicitly announcing itself as Marxist isn't taken seriously and is seen as too fringe to be legitimate. I remember vividly how one of my faculty advisors at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, not my main advisor, by the way, Michael Apple was cool, this other advisor tried to warn me against openly writing in the introduction to my book on high-stakes standardized testing, Unequal by Design, that my analysis was guided by Marxism. I was literally one of my semi-advisors sat me down and had this conversation with me regarding my dissertation and my book. I kept that radical confession in the text, but I also think hardly anyone noticed. And frankly, you'd have to be willfully ignorant not to read Marx into that book. However, my disappointment in that particular faculty advisor, as well as some seed of self-doubt about when, where, and how I should just quote-unquote come out as a Marxist, it clearly still lingers with me. That was just one instance, but there are countless others where in the academy, being a Marxist is too far out of the bounds of scholarly legitimacy for liberal and progressive professors to handle. So I've been very strategic about how I position myself within educational scholarship in order to maintain my legitimacy as a quote-unquote real and serious educational scholar without sacrificing my political integrity. Conversely, I haven't purposefully hidden the Marxist foundations of my research, and anyone who's paying attention should know their importance to my politics, writing, and speaking. But fear is not the only emotion I've encountered in writing this book. Importantly, I've also felt hope and uplift. As I was writing this, Donald Trump had taken over the presidency of the United States. White supremacist nationalism was on the rise, violent attacks and public hate speech increasing every day. And it's funny, like this is the old list, right? I mean, since then, the stuff we've seen has been like mind-blowing, right? There's been threats of anti-LGBTQ laws being pushed with new vigor in individual states. Attacks on women's bodies and their right to choose have been ratcheted up, especially now with the Supreme Court shift that's about to happen. Ohio's already got its next anti-abortion law teed up for that state. Trump trying to ban immigrants and refugees, all the talk about building a wall, discussions of spreading conservative Christian values through public school vouchers are being taken more seriously in the halls of the White House. Trump's attack on DACA, victories stalling the Dakota Access Pipeline have proven to be fleeting as the new administration renews its commitment to supporting big oil. Laws are being proposed to make protesters liable for costs of anti-war protests, police forces, and to make resisting arrest a huge hate crime against the police. Okay, these dire times have sparked an upsurge in activism and protests that is heartening and full of revolutionary potential. And I think a new generation of teachers could build upon this radical momentum by helping their students explore and consider Marxist and socialist ideas. This fact speaks to why I'm writing a book on Marxism and educational theory right now. And you know, honestly, like again, I wrote all this and all those teacher strikes hadn't happened yet, right? And so like, in a way I'm just like, oh man, like if we had waited 6 more months to bring the book out, we could have had a whole new section on this stuff, right? Yeah, right. We'll send it back to the printer. And suffice it to say, these are intensely political times. Both the present and future seem very uncertain, and while we face dread and despair on a day-to-day basis, we also reside in a moment of great possibility. For all the limitations of their liberal rhetoric and racial homogeneity, together the women's marches represented the largest single protest in the history of the United States. For many, these marches, which may have totaled more than 3 million people, were their first ever protests. And such first steps are critical to the development of critical consciousness and for building a mass movement. Similarly, in response to several people being detained in airports due to Trump's executive order banning immigrants and refugees from certain countries, large protests with thousands of people each developed almost spontaneously at major airports around the United States where people affected by the ban were being detained. Likewise, more protests and marches happened around the country the following day, and tens of thousands of major cities came out in support of immigrant and refugee rights. And this is on top of hashtag Black Lives Matter and the Occupy protest movements that emerged under the Obama administration. One thing is clear, new people are being activated, and this is something we should all be celebrating. And I was thinking about this real split, especially with the teacher uprisings and the statewide strikes, because you know, to me, it's like it's no mistake that it's all happening right now, right? We have the Janus decision happening, right? And that swing of conservatism is happening at the same moment, essentially, that we have a mass shift in sort of teacher consciousness and teacher resistance. So these contradictions presented by this whole, it's a whole, right? Got to see it all together at once. Tumult and violence, and then certainly, along with the possibility bred by growing resistance, are typical of times of great change. And in times like these, I personally feel the need to turn to theory to help me better understand the material realities that people, myself included, are experiencing. I want to make sense of things, and Marxist theory, in conjunction with ongoing practice, helps me do this. Marxist theory analysis always seemed to me to peel back the outer appearances while revealing relations, power, and mechanisms of change that were always lurking underneath. Marxist theory shaped who I was as a public high school teacher and a burgeoning education activist, and it shaped who I became as a professor, public intellectual, and radical scholar activist. Even if I don't always say it explicitly, Marxism is present in all of my analyses of education politics, policy, and practice, whether in academic articles, books, blog posts, or editorials. So in these breathtaking times, and literally I feel breath, like my breath being stolen, right? When it feels like there's a new atrocity committed and a new protest to attend almost every day, a Marxist education, this book, is a part of my commitment to understanding the politics of education in this world. It is an argument that Marxist theory helps us understand not only the process of teaching and learning, but also the politics of curriculum, the relationships between schools and capitalist production, and the building of critical consciousness toward resistance and social justice. Okay, so part of what I do here in this first chapter is it's a little bit built off a narrative about my own political development as well, right? And what kind of things influenced me. And so I want to read. I want to share some of that and talk about, because really, I've tried to think through, particularly this opening chapter, like how do we understand both, and this is part of the why I like the title we eventually came up with, was like, how do we both understand the concepts of Marxist education, what that means to bring this theory and bring this thinking and these politics into our thinking and practice as educators? But then how do we understand our own education as Marxists? Well, how do we get to where we are and think about that in the practice of our lives too? So what I start off with is something that probably years ago I would have gotten yelled at by my dad, was a section talking about, you know, my dad was a communist, right? And I was raised such as a red diaper baby. The reason why he would have yelled at me is because you're never supposed to talk about that out loud. At least I was always raised, like, don't tell the neighbors, don't tell the teachers, don't tell your friends, right? Because, well, you know, he came up in a time when there was a real danger, right? Speaking for what you, like, you know, there was real danger. So I was raised with that danger in the back of my mind as a kid, from when I was my own son's age, right? You know, 6, 7, 8 years old, thinking about that stuff. Okay, so my dad, the communist. For as long as I can remember, my dad has been a communist. What did that mean for me? Well, it meant a childhood of conversations and sometimes lectures about women's oppression and my job as a male to fight against that oppression. It meant that learning about U.S. war and imperialism around the world and understanding that our government was basically bombing kids just like me somewhere in Asia or Africa or the Middle East. It meant learning about police brutality and from a very early age, also learning that the police could not be trusted because as agents of the state, they will come after you or your parents or someone you know, since that is their job. Having a communist father also meant a life of secrets because you can't tell anyone that you have a communist father. Not your friends, not your neighbors, and certainly not your teachers. It also meant sticking out among classmates for not standing and reciting the Pledge of Allegiance to the American flag and navigating life as an atheist in Christian America. Quick side note, I was really good friends with the Jehovah's Witnesses in elementary school because they were also the other kids who didn't stand for the flag, right? And we were like, okay, like we got to be down like that. Those weren't lasting friendships, but I was. Okay. Having a communist father meant participating in many a May Day rally or march, both in Seattle and in the San Francisco Bay Area of my youth. One of those early memories includes a decision by marchers to swarm through the Nordstrom's clothing store in downtown Seattle. And as we wove our way between the clothing racks and perfume counters, I distinctly remember looking around and wondering to myself, you mean we can just do this and not get into trouble? Quickly followed by the realization, wow, you know, when people are together like this, we're hard to stop. One summer in the 1980s, when I stayed with my father, my folks are divorced by then, was at the height of the anti-South African apartheid divestment movement at UC Berkeley. My teenage sister, who was also very politically involved at that point, had been organizing and agitating with students and community activists, and they had symbolically constructed a shantytown to occupy the campus square. Some of you might remember that shantytown at UC Berkeley. Telegraph Avenue, that street that runs directly from the campus square, was also a site of protest, and as a part of the anti-apartheid march and rally, I recall just gleefully tossing toilet paper rolls through the signs and the trees along the street. Having a communist father meant that there were political meetings at our house, at the houses of others, and the quote-unquote war stories of fighting with the cops at a protest here, or fighting with the fascists on the shipyard docks while trying to organize workers there. It also meant growing with the tension between being quote-unquote political and being just a kid, right? Engaged in pop culture and still trying to figure himself out. Having a communist father did not necessarily guarantee that I turned out to be the radical that I am. I could have, if I ever write a biography, there's a whole section on my, like for instance, my brother, who became strung out and then turned to evangelical Christianity and even became like a promise keeper. Do you remember the promise keepers? But it did introduce me to a new worldview and opened some avenues of analysis for me. These became important in my path as a Marxist educator. Even though at the time I could not tie my childhood experiences to a specific intellectual or political tradition, these experiences and stories oriented me toward justice, and it taught me that people got together to fight injustice. My early experiences in protests in particular allowed me to glimpse moments of what it meant to feel free in some sense. I may not have understood what exactly I was feeling free from, but I definitely felt it, and it was something I came to feel again multiple times in multiple protests later in my life. Additionally, despite what I see as a lack of self-interrogation of his own racial identity, my dad did contribute to my own identity development in some key ways. I haven't talked to my dad since he's read the book, So I'm curious to see how he's going to respond to that line. So whether through simplicity, so my dad's Chinese American via Hawaii. Okay, so whether through the simplicity of food, his Tai Chi practice, or stories about our family history, I was learning about what it meant to be mixed, to be part of the Asian American and Chinese American diaspora, and what differentiated me from the predominantly white family members and non-Asian communities among whom I was living during my formative pre and early adolescent years. Sometime after my parents divorced, my mother remarried, and along with my brother and sister, we moved to my mom's hometown of Vernon, Connecticut. Anyone know anything about Vernon? Yeah, Vernon? Vernon is a predominantly, at least then, was a predominantly white suburb of Hartford, and moving there proved crucial to my political development in two ways. First, it was there, in Vernon, that I viscerally experienced blatant racism on a completely different scale than I had in my childhood in Seattle. Second, in part because I was pushing back against whiteness there, and in part due to our proximity to New York City, it was during that time of my life that I found hip-hop. Moving to Vernon in the fourth grade was a shock. I had gone from a very diverse working-class urban community in West Seattle to a super white, generally affluent suburban community in Connecticut. Living in Vernon shaped my racial political identity in some very important ways. It taught me, for instance, that even though I was quote-unquote mixed Chinese and white, in a lily white Vernon, my black hair and features were still a good giveaway to my peers. The first day on the bus to elementary school, as soon as I got on, I heard some of the older white kids in the back say out loud, "Look at that chink." My racist aunt had a black cat she named Sambo. My racist uncle used to complain when I would bring my black friends from school over to swim or hang out at her house. She was kind of rich. She had a tennis court. She had a swimming pool, that kind of stuff. So we always go hang out there in the summertime. My white friend had a Puerto Rican cousin, and his family, this cousin, was regularly called a pecan or a Rican dude. There was plenty of benevolent whiteness there as well. For instance, I remember one conversation with my white grandfather, very sweet man who was relatively wealthy, where he said he wanted me to join the Freemasons like he had. Right? Can you imagine? As soon as he had suggested it, however, he paused for a minute, clearly thinking to himself, and followed up by saying, "I think they're an international organization now." At that moment, it was clear to me that he was making a racial consideration about whether or not I could actually even join and be a Freemason. In these ways, Vernon, Connecticut introduced me to a whole new vernacular of racism that I hadn't heard articulated before. Various forms of racist othering also happened in Vernon as well. I was always used as an example by white teachers when it came to talking about family roots. You know, like, they'd always do the map, right? But see, in Vernon, it was like, everyone was like, okay, family East Coast here. I would always have West Coast, and I have Hawaii and China, right? So I'd always get used as this example. My name was constantly mispronounced by teachers, too. I knew I was the first or second on the class list on the first day of school when the teacher would look at their roster, pause, stumble a little, and then immediately say, I know I'm going to mispronounce some of these names, so please forgive me. I ate Chinese snacks that my friends thought were weird, and I knew how to make fried rice. I had a Chinese popo and a white grandmother. I had a two-part Chinese middle name of which no one can make sense. Why do you have four initials in your name? I was exotic, experiencing the kind of racist loved, this is what Frank Chin called racist loved, which was reserved for quote-unquote Orientals and Asian Americans. In these big and small ways, the whiteness of Vernon, Connecticut taught me about aggressively hateful racism, and it taught me about the kind, quote-unquote, kind of racism reserved for the exoticized other. Both are violent, and both shaped my racial identity, my racial political identity growing up. Thankfully, hip-hop saved me. In retrospect, my embrace of hip-hop music and culture was in part a rejection of my new white suburban surroundings and the overbearing whiteness that came with it, and in part a romantic clinging to the urbanness of my old neighborhood back in West Seattle. In Connecticut, I attended a large, comprehensive middle school that had two to three African-American students out of several hundred students total, and not counting myself or my siblings, typically had no Asian-American students, and certainly had no Latinx or Native kids either. It made perfect sense to me now that I became close friends with several of the African-American kids at school. They were more like the kids I knew back home in my diverse working-class Seattle, neighborhood in West Seattle. And one of our shared loves was hip-hop music and the growing b-boying and graffiti scenes, which at that moment had entered pop culture and were being mass marketed for the first time. In Connecticut, I found out I could stay up late on the weekend nights and fine-tune my boombox radio and catch New York City DJs cutting up and mixing hip-hop records of the early to mid-1980s. I wish, man, I had some tapes too recorded. I can't find those. It drives me crazy. In Connecticut, I found out, I could, let's see, my identification with hip-hop culture and blackness became an important political and racial rudder as I navigated Vernon's cultural politics of overwhelming whiteness, especially since I could not find much of a Chinese-American cultural home there. After middle school, my mom and I moved back to Seattle, where I attended Garfield High School, Go Bulldogs, located in Seattle's historically but now totally gentrified, or almost entirely gentrified, African-American community, once home of Quincy Jones, Jimi Hendrix, and the Seattle chapter of the Black Panther Party. Always negotiating a fluid and messy mix of whiteness, being Chinese-American, identifying with hip-hop culture, and attending Seattle's historically black high school, I continued to make my own political cultural way. At Garfield High School, I engaged my friends and peers on issues of culture and race politics through hip-hop music. I was also lucky enough to stumble upon two courses that took up African-American centric orientation on curriculum, one course around the Harlem Renaissance and a world history course on sort of African diaspora and Afrocentric history. We're having our time. Okay. Let's see, so those classes were really critical to my political intellectual development. I was always one of only two non-African-American students in that class, and certainly the only Asian-American student. And through that curriculum and through that class, much love to Mr. Davis, who was that high school teacher, we entered into incredibly important conversations and arguments about history, culture, race, and racism. Through those conversations and arguments, we also developed meaningful relationships with each other. All right, so anyways, I kind of document a little bit. I go through some stuff around my own development through in college and sort of the importance of that work and that protest work and identity work in college. I'm gonna skip forward to this to the section on when I became sort of becoming a teacher and some of my work there, okay? So at the Evergreen State College, I went to Evergreen, home of the Gooey Ducks. And I spent my first year in Santa Cruz, so I've been a banana slug and a gooey duck. I guess I have a thing for invertebrates. Okay, at Evergreen, I decided to work towards becoming a public school teacher. As an undergraduate, I began working with the Upward Bound program there, which provided support for students who were low income and the first generation of their families to attend college. Upward Bound and Evergreen taught me about the material realities of settler colonialism and native culture, and it only reinforced my desire to teach. Through the program, I visited indigenous kids in their homes on various native reservations around the Puget Sound region. In the process, I saw levels of poverty that I didn't know could exist in the United States, and I learned about Pacific Northwest native cultures in some very deep ways. I also worked with the African American, Latinx, white, and native students from urban schools and communities in Tacoma, Washington. Some of our students were on the edge of gang life, some had experienced abuse in their homes, some were dealing with drugs, either personally or in their families. All of them were poor, and all of them were sharp as nails. I love working with those students and their families, and I still miss them today. They gave me an education on the concrete realities for so many in this country, as well as they're one of the reasons it's important to teach and change lives, right? And change society by extension. After graduating from Evergreen with my bachelor's degree, I entered into the master's in teaching program. I eventually became a teacher, and I was fortunate enough to become a teacher at a middle college high school program in Seattle. And this is a program that basically serves quote unquote dropouts, right? It's a public part of the public schools, and sort of it was a way that the district would sort of get these students back into schools. That was a wonderful space. Again, another space that I missed incredibly. So one mini unit here's the thing, when you teach like dropouts and you teach those alternative programs, you're in a particular kind of liminal space in the district, right? Most of the times they don't watch you, right? These were kids that they were gonna lose anyways, and so as long as the principal stood off your back, so we were able to do all sorts of very subversive curriculum in this space. So I actually taught a unit on Marxism to those students, right? Focused on two things in that teaching. Surplus value was one. We wanted to get that concept, right? And then we also wanted them to understand historical materialism and to figure out ways to think about history as Marxists, right? We also read books like A People's History of the United States. That was our main U.S. history textbook. And we even read Galeano's Open Veins of Latin America as part of our world, thinking around world history, right? These were excerpted, and we didn't, it wasn't like we read the things back cover to cover, but we took it seriously. Another teaching unit that was critical for me my teaching partner Alonzo Ibarra and I did during one quarter was the one that we taught in the fall of 1999, which you all should know is important for Seattle. That year was historic for Seattle and for the anti-globalization movement around the world because the World Trade Organization was set to have its annual meeting there that November. In preparation for this, Alonzo and I focused our entire world history course on issues of globalization, neoliberalism, and the politics surrounding global expectation of people and their resources. It was a great unit that saw our students produce a class book of essays, poetry, and art that critically analyzed the WTO and neoliberalism. Even better was the massive protest, later iconicized as the Battle of Seattle, that followed on November 30th, 1999, as huge crowds took over the streets of downtown and anti-globalization activists successfully shut down the WTO meetings. Alonzo and I were at the protests. We couldn't officially be at the protests. You couldn't do a field trip to a protest, right? You'll get busted for that. But we called in sick. Our students knew where we were going to be. And on their own, many of our students voluntarily showed up to participate in the protests at varying levels as well. Seattle and the entire Puget Sound region, along with the rest of the world, vibrated for days after these protests, and the experience was transformational for all of us, teachers and students alike. In my mind's eye, I can still picture my students' faces in class the days after the protests, vibrant and full of the excitement about the history being made around them and even the history they helped make themselves. Again, I was feeling and seeing what it meant to be a critical and really a Marxist educator. Okay, so I'm going to pull off the introduction there, but I do spend some time talking about really trying to think through, like, my conundrum now is, like, I'm an academic. Right? I'm a researcher. I'm a teacher of teachers. I write a lot. And so, well, like, in this moment, I'm actually an administrator. That's the real question for me now. Is like, can you still be a Marxist and an administrator? And what does that mean? Right? I don't know the answer to that yet. Probably the answer is not for long, I think. But I really sort of try to pick through, like, how does this operationalize, you know, in terms of who I am. And so in the last chapter, I kind of bring it back to that, right? And try and think through a little bit, who is it that I am, and thinking through, like, how does that bring Marxism to my work as an educator, right? And in part of that reflection is to say, like, for me as someone with a PhD, you know, I have to be present in the community. I have to be sort of boots on the ground with who I am and what I do, right? There's so, the shitty thing about the academy, right, is that, you know, I end up being in so many ways, certainly the lone sort of Marxist professor and openly identified and speaking out on this kind of stuff, like in the whole Puget Sound, right? Like, I'm not just my university, not just the University of Washington, but, like, all those universities in the Puget Sound area, right? I mean, Jesse knows, because, like, if we have a protest on testing, like, I'm the one who shows up, right? And so you end up being this space where you feel like you're the only all the time, right? And so there's a whole thing I kind of try and think through about how do we survive that? Right, and we have to build community. And I gotta thank Brian Jones because he read some of the manuscript and gave some feedback. He's like, God, I read this, and you know, you might be the only Marxist, but you don't have to be the lonely Marxist, right? In terms of being an academic, right? And he's right, you know. And so, you know, we have to build community, and that's what it is all the time, anyways, right? As organizers, whatever, like, we're creating networks, we're trying to figure out ways to survive, we're building connections with folks who are doing this work, helping push consciousness along. Anyway, so let me talk a little bit about the chapters here, just kind of sort of speak through how I see this book, right? And really, honestly, I'm so happy that the strikes and rebellion, teacher strikes and rebellions and uprisings happen in so many states. I could have had a whole chapter devoted to that if I had done the book a little bit later, right? Anyways, so working through some of the chapters. Part of what I want to do here, what I did here is, you know, there's been ongoing arguments around how do we understand Marxism, like, relative to racism and colonialism in particular, right? And this struggle's been going on for decades and decades too, right? It's like, oh, well, is it race or class? Or is it class or race? And how do we do that, right? And so I wanted to wade into that fight a little bit, particularly because I feel like some of the critiques against Marxism are oftentimes actually badly misplaced by people who just haven't read any Marx, for one, right? And so I take some time to kind of pick through some of these discussions and how, and really, if Brian Jones is really great, if you want to talk about Marx's analysis of race and going back to like slavery and that kind of stuff, like his session this morning was really good in really detailed ways. But so I pick up some of those arguments, say, hey, look, yes, Marx started off as a Eurocentric in the beginning, but he actually moved over time, right? And he was very clear in some cases. For instance, it's really unfortunate, but like, it's only in a footnote that he says, really, I'm only talking about Western Europe's political economy and that development, and I'm not actually saying this should be applied to everywhere around the world, right? But that's in a footnote, right? And so if you miss that footnote, you're gonna think, okay, he's saying this is for everybody. And if he says this is for everybody, clearly it's not true. It's not what happened in India, it's not what happened in Latin America. I mean, there's all these, like, all those critiques can come out. So I take up that argument some. I also do something that I haven't seen done before, and I think is really important, is to kind of lay out and say, look, if Marx is committed to dialectical materialism, and we take that, or at least I take that as the core of what he is and what he does, then we also need to understand that you know, Marx may have been Eurocentric when he started, and he started to move from that as he did his analysis and grew and became more complex, but we also understand that dialectical philosophy is not European necessarily at all, right? And I think it's a really important thing for folks to get. So I spent some time here actually talking about how dialectics actually, existed in Aztec philosophy, for instance. Right, and there's a long history of dialectics and dialectical materialism in Chinese philosophy that goes back thousands and thousands of years. Okay, and then even if we want to sort of, you know, there's all that work around looking at Greek philosophy and Greek quote unquote civilization, right, and how a lot of that has roots in Africa. So you can go back to like the Kemetic, Egyptian philosophy, and actually find that Hegel got dialectics vis-a-vis classical Egyptian philosophy. Right, and so if we take that, so then we gotta start looking at it and start questioning. Okay, so you know, is Marxist like inherently Eurocentric because we've tagged Marx with it, and Marx is the white guy from Europe, right? Versus, I think philosophically, in terms of what guides his thinking, is actually very anti what we typically associate with European philosophies, like positivism and all those ideas around, you know, everything's static and everything is we can look at something here and generalize that for, but like that whole typical sort of Western science, the Marxist dialectics actually pushes against that. So I take some time sort of working through that, and then also trying to just highlight a couple pieces of history of like, look, you know, guess what? There's plenty of people of color who identify with Marxism and socialism as well, and I think it's important for us to continually to recapitulate that history so we understand that this is not just a white thing, and we understand that from all sorts of different angles. Other spaces, and so then I start to try to work through how do we apply these ideas in education. Chapter 3 really looks at the relationship between schools and capitalism and capitalist inequality, right? It looks at it from a historical perspective in terms of like in education and all elsewhere, there's a whole rise of what are called quote-unquote neo-Marxists, right? And that was super interesting for me. In fact, I wrote that paper originally way back when I was in grad school under Michael Apple, my advisor at Madison, and you know, I went to his class, and like literally, like I came out of my, you know about my background now, so I came to his class as a Marxist, and I literally went to his class and I was like, what the hell is a neo-Marxist, right? I was like, you're the Marxist or you're not, and I don't know what the neo thing was, right? And it turns out to me that the whole neo thing ended up being like all these various misreads on Marx and really mistaken reads of like saying, oh, Marx was an economic determinist. And you're like, no, he's not. Let's look and see what he actually says, right? There's all these kind of, Marx didn't think about culture or the state, look here, there's all these spaces where they did. But because folks presumed that they understood Marxism, they used that as a point of departure to say, hey, this, you know, he's wrong in this space. We need to create something new called neo-Marxism, right? And so that chapter is me going after that and trying to think that through, and then sort of again recovering some of the Marxist tradition in educational theory. And that's really one of the strands running through this whole book. One of my favorite chapters was a new one I wrote for this book, Chapter 4, Dispossession and Defiance, right? And that's one where I talk all the time, all sorts of places around how testing, high stakes status testing, neoliberalism, and all these other, you know, current sort of corporate ed reforms, how they're actually fundamentally racist. Okay, and they're always getting put right. This is, we always get, folks are always saying, oh, we need charter schools because that's going to help us create racial equality, right? That's always the case, right? Or same thing, we need the tests so it can show the numbers, so we can say, hey, look, there's some racism, we're gonna fix educational racism through tests, right? I stay just calling bullshit all the time. That's all I do, right? So I give that talk all the time. And so that chapter gave me a chance to say, okay, how do we coalesce all that data and put it in a way and help folks understand the argument that's going on here around that stuff, right? Because it's very clear, that's the thing, if you look at the evidence, both historically the tests are racist, philosophically the tests are racist, in terms of the content the tests are racist, and in terms of the outcomes the tests are racist, right? And that's just what they are. Right, and let's have that conversation, you know. And the same thing, you look at the charter schools, right? We know these market reforms never work for folks who are already poor because the markets keep poor people poor, and they end up being a mechanism essentially. And I've drawn David Harvey's work around accumulation by dispossession in this space about how you can use these reforms. Basically, you target communities of color which do bad on the tests. Right, they become the sites of intervention, and then the public monies that are in those public schools end up getting all that money ends up getting funneled into the coffers of essentially private industry or the nonprofit complex of folks just making money, because that's where all the interventions are going on. The new curriculum, the enormous rents for the charter schools, like all that money gets public money. It's all public money just taken out of those communities and put into the hands of the wealthy. So that chapter really works through that stuff. Chapter 5 is again, reclaiming the Marxist tradition in education. Again, when I got to grad school, everyone was like, oh, we love Vygotsky. Vygotsky is Vygotsky. And I was like, all right, that's cool, right? Zone of Proximal Development, ZPD. And then I started reading Vygotsky, and I was like, wait a minute. Like, this cat's straight out of Russian Revolution, because I'd already read Lenin. I already read What Is to Be Done, you know? And I was in this class with this philosophy professor, and I was like, look. And he said, write the paper. So I worked. That's an early version of that of that chapter was me kind of going and reading through, giving a close read of Vygotsky, and actually really unpeeling and unpacking some of the Marxist roots and relationships underneath Vygotsky's work, particularly relative to Lenin and thinking about Russian Revolution, right? And what I loved about that, and this is what everyone loves about Vygotsky, and I think it's great, right, is this whole idea of the social formation of consciousness, yeah. Right? And if that's the basis of our consciousness is social, then we have to understand that consciousness is also is changed and moved socially as well, okay? And then what's this dialectical relationship between individuals and society and the micro and the macro, like that whole thing. And so that's why Vygotsky's work is so powerful and so critical, and so we can see that at work, not only through, you know, Lenin's work in the Russian Revolution, but then we can start thinking about that at the classroom level too. Like, what does it mean as teachers? What are we doing as educators, right? And for me, the constant thing is I'm always pushing critical consciousness, always pushing critical consciousness. And really chapters 5, 6, and 7 in the book, chapter 6 deals with Paulo Freire, and chapter 7 deals with sort of standpoint in Marxist feminist epistemology and curriculum, right? And so the idea for me is that those should be seen as like a triumvirate of chapters, because we're basically looking at learning and teaching and curriculum, like all together. So Freire, again, in teacher education, everyone loves Freire, and I'd be like, yo, but he's a Marxist, and you guys aren't seeing that. Like they take the bits and pieces of it, right? And so I wanted to reach into that argument, that discussion. I love Freire too, and sort of go through, like, how do I see dialectical materialism at play in Freire's conception of pedagogy, right? And what does it mean as a teacher? What in terms of how we teach? How do we think about dialectics that way, right? And then again, the same thing through the chapter on curriculum, chapter 7, is to kind of say, you know, there is a politics of knowledge at play. And if we think about consciousness as being social, then curriculum itself has to be about constructing like environments in our classrooms that help students see things in particular ways. Like, that's what we do. That's our business as teachers. But if we recognize all that, that means that there's a politics in everything in terms of our curriculum, right? And so this is a little bit of curriculum theory and saying, hey, you know, when we teach, we're always bringing our, you know, our social locations, our socio-political standpoints with us, powers with us all the time, and that's in our curriculum, and we need to like work through that and make and surface that in our teaching. And then finally, in chapter 8, like I said, I try to circle back and really just reflect on like what, you know, how do we bring this into our lives? There's reflections on, a little bit of reflection on parenting in there, right? What does it mean to be a Marxist, you know, and a parent, right? You know, how do I be a parent at a school, right? How do I interact with my son's teachers and his, you know, I do all this work, you know, whatever, publish all this stuff and I speak, and I gotta go walk and talk to his principal and his teachers, you know, and like, and what does that mean? And how do I do that? How do I intervene or not intervene? And then also pick through a little bit about, you know, as a college professor, like what games do I have to play, right? And the worst of it is this: I have to play some sort of respectability politics to survive in the academy, right? Less so now because now I'm officially a full professor, right? Whatever that means. And so, but you know, as I'm coming up, I have to publish in established journals because I need to get tenure and prove to these a-holes up here somewhere, right, that I'm legitimate enough to keep my job. At the same time, that's necessary too, because then I have to flip it and go and say, okay, by gaining that stature or holding that spot in the academy, I can turn around and I can go out and last week I gave an interview just smashing on Bill Gates' failed teacher evaluation stuff, right? And so, yeah, I write a fair bit about Bill Gates in here too, but that's very politically dangerous in Seattle. Right. If you go to my university and look at the first name on the list of who gave to build the building that I'm in, the first name is Bill and Melinda Gates. Right. And so, what does it mean to like go after them and their foundation, like in their backyard? Right. But playing that game with the academy, like creates the space for me to do this other more radical work as a public scholar, as a public intellectual. And so, I kind of try and sort through that a little bit here too, and just sort of talk through that about, you know, what does it mean to be a Marxist in the academy, and like, you know, and so there's, yeah. Anyways, so I'm out of time officially. Thank you for coming, and I'm looking forward to the conversation. And
the preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.